This is the Faith Debate, a theological roundtable gab fest with the Mix Master as the master of ceremonies and the notorious Triple B, the big bridge builder. Can we build it? Yes, we can. The Faith Debate is a free-for-all forum.
Hoo-ah!
Where faith community leaders wrestle over the truth.
Yabba-dabba-doo.
In less than 30 minutes, learn more about what really matters than others learn in a month.
Ooh, how convenient.
Are you ready for a clash of ideas? Are you ready for the sound of freedom?
Let's get ready to rumble!
Let's get ready to rumble.
Ha! Yeah!
In this corner, weighing in with a Master of Divinity from Reformed Theological Seminary, the Faith Debate Master of Ceremonies, Troy Skinner.
Got a moron.
And in this corner, weighing in as a pastor, teacher, and founder of Bridges, connecting needs and resources in the local community.
Ooh, mama.
The notorious big bridge builder, John Switzer.
Now, I'm just getting warmed up.
Different people can tend to interpret the Bible differently. Have you noticed? This raises the question how different interpretive groups have emerged and whether this is a good or a bad thing. Is it unfortunate or is it full of potential for deeper understanding? This month on the show, we've been talking through some of the different approaches by various hermeneutical schools of thought. There's your word of the week. In other words, groups that seem to perceive the scriptures and interpret them differently, and how so. On the panel this week, Jonathan Switzer, founder of Bridges, Reconnecting Needs and Resources in Frederick County, and Michelle Rader, who is, among other things, pursuing a Master of Arts in Theology degree from St. Mary's College. And she's got a book that she had assigned to her as part of her study. And I think that she helped as a research assistant or something. I don't know. I can't get all the details together. But she's smart and she knows a lot of stuff. And last week I cut her off in the middle of a really important thing she was saying. So before you get into your thought from last week, the historical note that you were sounding, the book again is
Scripture and Its Interpretation, edited by Michael Gorman. And you can find it on Amazon.
You can find everything on Amazon.
Yep. Things you don't want to find.
Yeah. Ain't that the truth? So you were making a kind of a point on history. So,
yeah, it's just a lot of people don't know. I wasn't aware until I read a book on this last year by Philip Jenkins, The Lost History of Christianity, that for the first 800,000 years of Christian history, the church in the East was actually very vibrant, and there were more Christians in the Eastern church than in the Western church. We're so used as inheritors of the Western tradition to just only thinking of that part of the church. And in fact, a lot of people just don't even remember or that there is an Eastern church, that there are still Eastern Orthodox.
So when they say that, do they, is he, like, how far east? Is he talking, like, into India, into China? Or is he saying, as far as, like, Pakistan and Afghanistan, like,
more of the Central Asia and Middle Eastern. There were Christians going as far as India and China, but the big centers would have been more like Armenia and Iraq and what today are more the Middle Eastern.
And
Central
that's an
Asian.
Important thing to keep in mind. I have somebody I talked to once who was doing missions work in Japan, and one of the big challenges is to get the Japanese to understand that this wasn't a Western religion. Mm-hmm. And he made it a big part of his argument, saying, no, the church has roots in the East, even more so as far as the roots go, more long-lasting and initially deeper than even in the West. And then he makes the point about how Christianity has influenced the faith traditions within Japan without Japan even realizing that they're Christian influenced. And once he's able to make that point and find a common ground, then they'll kind of hear him out, because it's not some foreign invader philosophy. It's, oh, so this is Japanese? Okay, I guess I'll listen. So I don't think we do the church any favors by constantly thinking in terms of Western ideas and traditions.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that goes right back to Paul, certainly, in his sermon on Mars Hill in Athens, looking for something in their culture to relate to. And it's a very different sermon than what he preaches in the Jewish
context.
When
I asked the question, as you were raising this part of the church that got wiped out in the East, the Middle East, and up into Asia, is it possible that the interpretive approach of those people in the church was more susceptible to Islam than the other part of the church? And I've wondered this only because Islam ends up being such a major player in world religion, and of course, Christianity and Islam fighting so much through the years. And it appears to me like right at, you know, this Constantinople, this place where it was the Antiochian approach, which was more literalistic in its interpretive approach, as opposed to the Eastern Orthodox groups that were more allegorical in their approach. And there's so much more going on than just interpretive approach there, that it's probably too much to boil that down. But I've wondered often if that was, again, something that God chose, that the groups that were more allegorical, they're the ones that got wiped out. And so what ended up happening historically is that the one that survived, was that God's choice, that the more literal approach would survive, as opposed to, not like they both haven't survived, but certainly the one seemed to become more representative of the church that survived.
Yeah, I haven't thought about those terms. I don't know if I'd want to put too much weight on that because of the recurring theme of the remnant. I mean, the prevailing majority, overwhelming view in Jesus' day among the Jews was the wrong view. So just because it's the majority view doesn't mean it's the right one. So I don't know if I'd want to put a whole lot of stock in that argument if it were me, but...
If it's not the remnant view, it can't be the right view.
If I'm not the minority, I'm standing in the wrong place.
So it'd be wrong to look at it both ways. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you're looking at historical sweep and trying to, you know, nail down what is the deciding factor as to why a particular group survives or thrives or not, there's so many things involved in that, and, you know, including things beyond that group's control, you know, violence, wars, things like that. It can be really hard to...
But an angel came down and told me what happened to that particular group. So that's how I know.
And, I mean, just from even in the Bible, you can see certainly very godly people who got martyred and wiped out, so...
We're starting to lean into the wind a little bit on the idea of focusing more on the different traditions within Christianity. Mm-hmm. But I had a note to myself, so I want to make sure before I move in that direction, is there anything that you guys might want to say about the move across time that we haven't already talked about? The pre-modern, we've talked a lot, particularly ancient terms. Mm-hmm. We haven't done the immediately pre-modern stuff very much. I don't know if you have anything you want to say there. The modern era, and I would argue we've now entered into a post-modern era. Mm-hmm. So do we want to talk about that at all? Have we touched enough on those in our various discussions over the last, you know, 2+ shows that we should move on? Or,
well, it probably is worth just saying that the Enlightenment and the shift from, you know, pre-modern and medieval times into a modern and then ultimately a postmodern period has been huge in terms of its impact on the church and on biblical interpretation. You know, with the Enlightenment, understanding that as the time when, you know, what counted as knowledge really got redefined. You know, before that time, everybody believed that there was a God, and it didn't seem possible to believe otherwise. And the Enlightenment was when, from Christians studying science, studying the material world, there started to grow this idea of the material world and what can be studied and measured is really the knowledge that counts for public discussion, and things that can't be measured or proved are not as, don't count for as much as knowledge. And of course, you know, where does that leave Scripture? Because it's both. I mean, there are obviously historical things that you can measure and verify in Scripture, and then there's a lot that's about faith and the Spirit, so...
Yeah, in fact, Aquinas is a key player in that because he's credited with kind of the revival in the church of through Plato and Aristotle, Aristotle in particular, kind of re-encouraging the use of reason as a major tool for thinking through theology and how we interpret the Scriptures. And then was it Lorenzo Valla though I don't think he was Christian, but he was saying back to the sources. He was saying, you know, let's go back to what Aristotle and the original Greeks taught. But then it's Luther that says the same thing in the Christian world, you know, that Aquinas went the wrong way and there's too much use of reason. We need to go back to Scripture, sola scriptura, right? And so that there's kind of a move away from just the Scriptures and then a move back to it. But when we move back to it, feels to me like a lot of the allegory was taken out, and with Luther and then Calvin, you know, there's this emphasis on what exactly does, you know, the literal sense, what does Scripture say? And so again, we have a major shift in theology, you know, in how we approach the Scriptures that happens at that time frame.
And it's brought all of that has brought us to where we are today. So it's helpful to think in terms of these. I mean, they're broad brushstrokes. Mm-hmm. When you're trying to talk about entire people groups over millennia, I mean, you're really being almost dangerously generalistic. But it can help to see these broad sweeps in time and how it's brought us to where we are. So to your point, at one point, everybody pretty much is thinking there's a God. Or multiple gods. There are gods. There's a supernatural. There's somebody who's controlling the thunder and the lightning and the crop yields or the hunt successes or the birth of children. All of those sorts of things. So maybe it's I have my God, you have yours. Or you have your slate of gods, I have mine. Maybe mythological gods or idols that have been constructed out of raw materials or Mother Nature is God. Kind of a pantheistic idea. All these sorts of things are the competing interests. And then reason and science and this Enlightenment period comes along. And I would argue that that's not a saying that we've opened up the possibility of there being no God. I think that I would argue that that's rejecting all of those other gods that I just alluded to and replacing them with me as God. And I'm the arbiter of what's right and true. And I'm going to measure it and figure it out because I'm going to be the one who's all-knowing. And so we put our faith instead of this supernatural entity into the natural entity over which we pretend we have control. And that's the modern era. And there were great advances that take place technologically and innovatively and, living conditions and all that sort of stuff. However, some really horrible things happened as a result because when I'm my God and you're your God and we disagree, well, the gods can war with each other and millions of people can die. And so now we're in what I think is the early stages of the postmodern. We've exited. There are obviously some remnants, but we've pretty much exited now the modern where we don't trust anything. We don't trust that there's a supernatural, and we don't trust the natural. We don't trust other men and women to make decisions and do the morally right thing, or even to come to grips with what is the morally right thing. We can't know. We can't know good from bad. We can't know right from wrong. And, of course, we can't live that philosophy. So I think that the postmodern era will be a relatively short era, but it's where we are right now. It's going to have to snap into something else because it's not livable. I can't know that if I step out into that traffic, that semi-tractor trailer won't squash me like a bug. Well, yes, you can. Just go step out in front of the semi-tractor trailer and see if it squashes you like a bug. You can know what you think you can't know. So it's not livable. So that's where we are now. And people are grappling with the Bible with this influence. I can't know if it's true. I can't know if there's even a God who was involved in writing this. I can't trust my pastor. So I can't, or my colleague who's telling me what to believe about it. So we end up not being able to trust anything and then ultimately even ourselves. So how might that influence the passing on of the faith tradition? How might that influence Bible translation? Will there be a postmodern Bible translation within 20 years? And what would that look like? Can we even imagine?
It feels to me like we're at the end of a season of reason. That was a cool quote.
If you write a book, you got to call it that.
A season of reason. that the postmodern is all about recognizing the limits of reason, and even some of the interpretive techniques in the emergent church. The next generation millennial and X generation theologians that are postmodern in their approach. It seems to me like what they're doing is they're. The service that they're giving to the church, let me put it that way, is a service that says reason is not as powerful as we think it is. So let's question a whole bunch of things right now, almost like it's a cleansing of, the last couple hundred years of theological hubris, and it's a time of cleansing all that out. Helping us to come back to, okay, what is it that is really stable, and reliable? In that sense, that's a good thing, even though in this season, a lot of people are throwing out a lot of stuff that shouldn't be thrown out, and likely people will, not make it to heaven, that there's people that, well, I don't know how far I want to go with that. That was such a judgmental approach to go. But it's felt to me like we're in a very dangerous era. Where so much is getting thrown out that we're losing our faith in. And so now that I've found a positive way to look at all that, maybe it's not as much as I thought it was.
Well, I think every age has pluses and minuses, and it's very tempting to, look back at a different age and say, oh, they had it right. Better then. C.S. Lewis says we should read old books, not because people in a different time didn't make mistakes, but they didn't make the same mistakes that we make. And, you know, I think you can look at each time period and you can see things that were maybe brighter than what we understand now, and you can see blind spots. We undoubtedly have blind spots that other ages will look at and laugh at. But I
look at them and laugh at them now.
Yeah. But I think,
yeah, I want to think that we don't have blind
I don't need
spots,
to wait.
You know? This is the hubris of our age, the evolution, you know, that
we know better than every other age that has come before.
Yeah.
But I think postmodernism has brought some good insights because, like you said, it has, you know, it has really questioned this idea of modernism that if we can just assemble all the objective data, we can know for sure. And postmodernism has really, you know, had the more humble insight of, you know, there's nobody, there's no individual person or individual group or individual culture that can ever have an objective view from which to assemble all the data and know something completely.
That's Michelle Rader with a really generous way of describing the postmodern view, and I appreciate that, actually. I mean
we're living it, yeah.
And Jonathan Schweitzer is the one saying we're living it. I'm Troy Skinner. This is the Faith Debate on 930 WFMD. Yeah, because there is a humility in acknowledging that we can't figure it out, but there's also the hubris of saying that it can't be known. You know, there is no absolute truth. Well, that's an absolute true claim, and so that's why I say it's not livable. It doesn't, and if we're not careful, I think we can glean helpful insights if we borrow a postmodernist script for a while and examine our own faith through that lens. It might, you know, reveal some things to us in surprising ways. But if we grab onto it too much, I think we'll rob ourselves of a language with which to explain, articulate, and defend our faith, because you have no language left. Things don't mean anything anymore. We're seeing that in the broader culture right now, right? Male and female don't really mean anything anymore. It's whatever you decide you are in the moment, sort of a thing. Well, if things are that fluid, you can't have any sustainable communication.
Well, I think that you know, as a Christian, we would say there is absolute truth, but I think the humble postmodern perspective as a Christian is to say, but no one person or one group can claim to arrive at a place where they know all that truth. Only God is the only one who is truth and knows all truth. And I think that's been the blind spot in a lot of previous generations and approaches, is this idea of, well, me and my group can know all the truth. We do know all the truth. And that's what has caused a lot of the conflict or a lot of the oppression over.
I think there are certain truths that any Christian can know with absolute certainty. Right, there are certain, they're the foundational, fundamental truths of the faith, and we all can and should, if we're Christians, agree on those things. It's the areas where we end up talking about on this show, where we have to agree to disagree, and we have to be humble and say, you know what, I think I know, but I might not know the answer to that question. What do you think? And allow my iron to sharpen iron, right? Well, allow my views to be sharpened.
You know, how do I want to say this? I even want to argue for the benefit of the argument, since we're the Faith Debate, you know, that, you know,
it's the sound of freedom.
Yeah. Thomas Jefferson, that great theologian, said back in the day. But when we think about where reason in Aristotle
it was Lady Bird Johnson, by the way, not
developed.
Who said,
That said that phrase?
Yeah, Clash of Ideas is the Sound of Freedom was Lady Bird Johnson.
It wasn't Thomas Jefferson?
Thomas Jefferson, no.
No, it's got to be Thomas Jefferson.
He's a woman.
He had a lot of really good quotes, but that wasn't
one of them. Your historical critical approach is really irritating me right now. How is it that Aristotle and reason was brought back to Aquinas, right? It was brought back because the Muslim theologians had kept it alive. Right, Muslim theologians, philosophers, educators, and then Aquinas grabbed a hold of it. But I feel like what happened then in the Western world is that we went ahead and tested the limits. I mean, it's been a long 1,000 years of testing, you know, the limits of reason and where that could go. But it's brought us to this, you know, place of postmodernism in a way that I think, you know, kind of eats the meat and throws out the bones of Greek philosophy. I mean, what Nietzsche was so great at was that he recognized that our attempt to use reason to analyze God had left him dead. You know, we cut him into so many parts that, you know, it's unreasonable. It's no longer valuable. And so, you know, the rise of postmodernism, you know, really for the last century, it's not just something that's happening in, you know, in this century, it's something that was really happening over the last century. That rise of postmodernism is not the death of reason, but it's certainly the corralling of it in recognizing that the goddess reason should not be a goddess, should not be worshipped. You know, there's a role for it, there's a place for it, but, you know, that we need to put it in its place. And argument has allowed us to get there, you know, as a culture. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, the way I understand it, argument. I think, you know, what we now think we understand about postmodernism, I think it, you know, it really begins to take its current form following World War II. People were really baffled by what the heck just happened. Mm-hmm. And then it gets a lot of momentum with the Cultural Revolution of the 60s. And by that point, the seminaries had gone off the deep end in large measure. And so it just gathered more and more momentum. And by the late 90s, it was a fait accompli that postmodernism would overtake modernism. And I think within the last 15 years, I mean, I can't peg it, but within the last 15 years, I think it's happened. Did it happen 15 years ago, 14 years ago, 10 years ago? I don't know. But within the last 15 years, it's kind of happened where I think postmodernism is winning the day against modernism. There's still kind of a cultural clash going on, but that's my understanding. The world according to Troy.
Yeah, and so I would take it back as far as Samuel Taylor Coleridge and who's the poet from up in you know that.
Well, I'm not saying that it arrived whole cloth out of nowhere. There's always going to be precursors, but I'm talking about a cultural movement that
no, totally, yeah.
That's more than just the philosophical smart guys that we can't even understand when we read them.
Yeah,
I'm not talking about those guys.
Yeah,
I'm talking about the Beatles. Okay,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
The postmodernists that are the Beatles
came into its own.
Yeah,
after about 150, yeah, 200 years of it being thrown around by,
well,
some,
believe
really
it or
intelligent
not,
people.
Show number three is done.
That was quick.
I know, right? I barely feel like this one got started. I have so much more I want to talk about. Maybe next week I'm going to throw out there a couple of idea starters and then just say go, and we'll see what happens.
Okay. All right, sound last good? One there's rotten
sounds
in.
Good.
Jonathan Switzer, Michelle Rader, I'm Troy Skinner. You are you, and you're listening to The Faith Debate on 930 WFMD. Visit us online at WFMD.com, keyword faith, or you can look at the drop-down menu for the shows on the station, find The Faith Debate, click on it. There you'll find John's picture, huh? Good looking guy.
Woo.
My picture, our bios, links to podcasts of previous shows, and it'll also tell you what next week's show is going to be. So you can look later today, probably. If you check later today, it'll tell you what next week's show is going to be all about. Huh?
Very nice.
We'll figure that out between now and later today.
Anticipate.
Until next week, 167 and a half hours from now, God bless.